My name is John. I'm one of the clergy, one of the ministers who works here. And it is my honor and privilege to welcome all of you here to our very first Spanberg lecture, part of the Spanberg lecture series. Now, I notice many familiar faces here, but I also notice many new faces. Some of y'all I don't recognize. So if you are new or visiting, I invite you to, after this lecture is done, I'll be waiting right over there. If you have any questions about St. Martin's, want more information about St. Martin's, feel free to come and tap me on my shoulder, introduce yourself. I promise you, I'm a very warm person. And I'd love to share as much as I can about our wonderful parish. There's many people who made this evening a success, and I really want to thank them all. So let me first begin with thanking Julie, my assistant. Without her, I don't know where I would be in many ways. Justin, our event staff and a team of AV specialists. Also want to thank Wesley, who's my colleague. Last week, I was out on spring break with my kids, and Wesley really ran this train while I was taking a break, and I really want to thank him for that. And I also want to thank the many volunteers who showed up tonight to help out. And a special thank you to the 7 or so gentlemen I got to work with over the past many months who've been driving this thing for a long time now. So if I forget your name, please forgive me. But special thanks to Jim McCullough, Chris Young, Greg Thomas, Jim Phillips, Larry Baker, Kevin Stuckey, and notable thanks to Jim Noteware, Joe Verin, and Perry Ruthven. And most importantly, a special thank you to Ron Spanberg, who is no longer here with us, but is on that other shore. And we really want to thank him for his vision. You know, he had a wonderful vision of launching these lecture series, and it's in his memory that these lecture series are named. Just a few words about Ron. He was an incredibly generous and faithful member of St. Martin's. He grew up in an era where the motto for many an American was God, family, and country. And that's how he lived. And I think I'm not the only one who thinks this, but I'm afraid to say it's certainly an ethos that is not always prevalent these days. It's at least harder to find these days than in decades ago. Ron was also concerned about the direction that our country was going in. I don't think that should be too surprising for any of us, regardless of our political spectrum, our beliefs, our faith, our creeds. There's a kind of social angst, regardless of who you talk to, about the future of this country. And this was certainly also the case for Ron. However, Ron also believed in a solution to the problem. He believed that if we could all have a common foundation to discuss from, at least then, if we are disagreeing, which many of us will, it'll be easier to know what we are disagreeing about. And we won't have to villainize the other. And so, Ron's vision launched the Spanberg Lecture Series, and his family is right here with us, and I really want to welcome them as well. And I hope that what we get out of this lecture series as well is a common understanding of what it is our country is made up of, how it started, the values, the ethos that formed and shaped it, such that when we find people that we want to disagree with, we're able to do it from a place of understanding. So let me introduce you to Tom. It is my great honor and privilege to introduce Tom Holland to us. Now, I hope no one here was expecting the Spider-Man actor, right? Tom Holland, this Tom Holland, is the British historian who has written many more books than the Hollywood celebrity. And one of the books that he wrote that part of his lecture is going to be based on is this wonderful book here called Dominion. And Dominion, what I appreciated about Dominion is that it brought to life what I have always considered the boring parts of history. As many of you know, as priests, we all have to go to seminary, and at seminary, we all have to learn about church history. And I told Tom today at lunch, I said, I wish I had this when I was in seminary, because this would have been a game changer for many a student trying to understand the historical facts about church history. More importantly, however, I found Tom's depictions of Jesus in the book, and this is not a religious book by any means, it's a historical book. I found Tom's depictions of Jesus incredibly moving. And I remember putting the book down and having to take a moment because of how much his words stirred in my heart. So let me just read you an excerpt. Jesus' manner of teaching was nothing like that of a philosopher. those who paraded their virtue and commended the faults of others, Jesus dismissed as painted tombs having a heaving with maggots and corruption. The standards of virtue he preached, to love one's enemy, to abandon all our worldly goods, they were too demanding as to seem impossible to meet. He was peculiarly tender with sinners. No one quite like him had ever been portrayed before in literature. The measure of this was that Christians, when they read the Gospels, they were able to believe that the man whose life the Gospels depicted, a man whom they described as weeping, sweating, and bleeding, a man whose death they vividly and unsparingly related, had indeed been what Paul claimed him to be, the Son of God. Beautiful. I would strongly encourage, if you haven't already bought your copy, to pick up a copy. We have a few being sold in the back there. I strongly encourage you to pick up a copy. And I also want to invite Tom to come forward. Let's give him a warm welcome. Tom will speak for about 1 hour or so, and after that, we'll have a moderated Q&A. So how many of you all got one of these when you came in? Okay, so we're going to use this for our Q&A, and I'll give us more instructions about that. But you've heard enough from me. You didn't pay to hear me. So I really want to have Tom come up here and take us away. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much. And yes, just to reiterate, my huge apologies for anyone who thought they were coming to see Spider-Man this evening. I mean, I might be Spider-Man. If I was, I wouldn't say, would I? So maybe I am. Who knows? And I would also like to thank you all for coming out on this kind of basically British evening of drizzle. Thank you. You know, thank you to the weather gods of Houston for making me feel at home. But above all, thank you for the great honour that I've been done in coming here to give a talk in memory of Ron Sponberg. So I've met his friends who he studied the Bible with and who asked me, so I would like to thank them. And I would like to thank his family who I met just before giving this talk. I'd like to thank his wife and his daughters and his grandchildren. And I can only say that his grandchildren do him tremendous credit. One of them told me that in the Napoleonic Wars, he would have sided with Britain. And another complimented me on my accent. So I'm very, very grateful. And I'm delighted that I can start this talk with reference to the idea of generations of people coming to a church and commemorating their loved ones in the context of a church. Because tonight I want to talk about the sweep of Christian history. I want to argue that the Christian Revolution is, I think, the profoundest cultural change in the history, not just of the West, but of the entire world. And it's a story that is often told in terms of titanic figures, emperors and popes and celebrated reformers and so on. But it is a story that is also fundamentally dependent on the idea of truths and stories being passed down from generation to generation. If you think about it, it is incredible, because generationally, it is something that takes us all the way back to the age of the Roman Empire. Christianity with Judaism provides us with a living link to a fabulously ancient past. And that's something that I want to explore today. And because of that, because basically my argument is that to live in the West is to be shaped by Christianity in ways so profound that we barely even recognize them. It doesn't matter if you go to church or not. You can be an atheist, you can be an agnostic, you can belong to other religions, but your assumptions about what human nature is, for all that, will have been shaped by the Christian story. And therefore, of course, I am not saying that I stand outside this story. I am absolutely a part of it. And so I thought it would be appropriate, therefore, that I begin by explaining how I've come to stand here, where my understandings of Christianity have originated from and evolved over the course of the years. So, as you can tell, probably, I am not American. I come from England. And this is the church that I went to. It's in a village called Broadchalk outside Salisbury, which has England's highest spire. It was the victim of a chemical attack by Russian agents that you may have read about a few years ago. And it's very near Stonehenge. This particular church goes back to the 13th century, but it stands on the site of an earlier church. And so I, going to church, my mother is a very devout Christian. And so there was never any question that I would be going to church. You know, I felt that I was in the presence of these kind of countless generations that had worshipped there before. And because I respected and loved my mother, I never felt any kind of hostility to institutional Christianity. I respected its morals, its teachings, its ideals. I absolutely loved the Bible stories. And I particularly loved the Bible stories that involved violence, of which there were an incredible number. I'm going to be honest, I much preferred the Old Testament. There was a lack of people having tent pegs hammered through their skulls in the New Testament, or little boys felling Philistine giants as here. So this was one of my favourite books, a collection of Bible stories by David Kossoff, the great Jewish writer. And here, of course, is David and Goliath. So I always had a kind of passionate interest in the stories that could be read in the Bible. But there were a couple of shadows over my Christian belief. And I guess that as I grew older, they kind of lengthened. So the first of these is tomorrow. I'm very much hoping to go to your Museum of Natural History and see the dinosaurs, because I was one of those little boys who adored dinosaurs. And I remember going to Sunday school and coming across this collection of Bible stories. So there's, you know, there's what are the kind of various animals, of which the one that stood out for me was obviously the brachiosaur and the pterosaurs flying overhead. And there are Adam and Eve down in the bottom. And the one thing I knew was that no human being had ever seen a dinosaur. And so I asked my Sunday school teacher, what's going on here? And she kind of slightly kind of flammed it. And it was the first shadow of doubt. So a very kind of precocious 19th century Darwinian kind of slight hint of a religious crisis. But that wasn't really what kind of came to dim my Christian faith. It was actually the fact that from dinosaurs, I graduated to an obsession with ancient civilizations. So I talked about how much I enjoyed the violence in the Old Testament. I also loved the violence, say, in Greek myths, in Roman history. And this it was that got me into the New Testament, because, of course, the Romans appear in the New Testament. And indeed, it's the Romans who sentence Jesus to death. And my terrible confession is that in the Easter story, when Christ is brought into the presence of Pontius Pilate, I was completely team Pontius Pilate. Jesus just seemed like a kind of scruff. Pontius Pilate, I mean, look at him, absolutely brilliant. His toga, he's got soldiers, a kind of marble columns, absolutely brilliant. Legionaries, loved it. And It was a sense of identification with the power and the glamour and the swagger of these kind of apex predators of antiquity, the great empires. So Egypt, Syria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and above all Rome, that put the protagonists of the Bible slightly in the shadow. And even worse, the gods I really came to love were the Greek gods, who I thought they had a kind of rock star charisma. They were terrible, but they were so interesting in the ways that they were terrible. And I came to identify more and more with Greece and with Rome. And it wasn't that there was a kind of dramatic Damascus conversion in reverse. I didn't lose faith, dramatically, but it was more like a dimmer switch going down. Or if you like, being blotted out by a brighter light. And for me, that brighter light was the light of the classical civilizations and of Rome in particular. And so when in due course I began to write works of history, I focused on these empires that had so fascinated and obsessed me when I was young. It was a kind of an enduring obsession and a great privilege for me to be able to write about something that had fascinated me for so long. And so I wrote about the age of Julius Caesar, and I wrote about the Spartans, the 300 Spartans who fought at Thermopylae against the might of the Persian Empire. And these were stories that had thrilled and moved and inspired me when I was young. But I found, as an adult, having to try and get inside the heads of these ancient peoples, I began to find the experience unsettling. I began to find that these people with whom I had always identified were terrifying, were alien, were deeply, deeply antithetical to beliefs and convictions that I realized were contradictory in so many ways to assumptions that the Greeks and the Romans had taken for granted. So, for instance, when I wrote about Julius Caesar, this is a man who, in his conquest of Gaul, it is said, killed a million Gauls, enslaved another million. And rather than being embarrassed about this, he thought it was tremendous. He staged great triumph session in Rome, and people carried placards boasting about how many people he'd killed. And he hauled his captives before the cheering crowds of Rome to demonstrate his greatness. Or when I thought of the Spartans who died at Thermopylae, these were a people who had provided Hitler with his inspiration. These were a people who had enslaved a neighbouring people and bred them very consciously to be as doltish and slave-like as they possibly could. I had to try and see the world through their eyes, but it brought home to me just how alien they were. And it began to worry and perplex me. What had happened? What had changed? Why did I find them so different? And a bit like when you have a kind of itch on your back, and you can't quite find it, and then you find it and you start scratching it and it's absolutely brilliant. So it was with me. And I began to contemplate the possibility that actually the reason I found them so unsettling was because I had been shaped by what I began to think had actually been the great transformation in the course of Western history, and that perhaps this transformation had been the coming of Christianity. The Christianity was both the most enduring and the most transformative consequence of classical antiquity in the Mediterranean. That it had been a kind of cuckoo in the Roman imperial nest, and that it had changed everything, and that my sense of anxiety about what the Romans and the Greeks had done and the way they saw the world was expressive of that. And so I thought, well, I will write a book. I will try and see whether this is an assumption or a theory that I can stress test. And while I was doing that, I'd begun it. I'd written about 2.5 chapters of it. And I got a commission from a TV station in Britain to go and make a film about the Islamic State, who you'll remember, very radical Islamist group that took over a vast swathe of territory in Syria and northern Iraq in 2014. And they occupied areas in northern Iraq that were inhabited by Christians and were inhabited by a people called the Yazidis. Some of you may or know about them, but just for those who don't, the Yazidis are a very small number. There are about 300,000 of them. And they have a faith that is kind of very eclectic. It's a compound of all kinds of different beliefs. So Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Zoroastrian, maybe even beliefs that go back to ancient Babylon. And they have always been viewed by Muslims as not just pagans, but devil worshippers. They celebrate an angel who echoes a story that in the Quran has Satan as at its center. And so when the Islamic State occupied the area where the Yazidis lived, and particularly a town called Sinjar, which was their major center of habitation, they launched violent persecutions against them. They killed the men. They enslaved those women and girls as young as 8, who they thought were sexually attractive, and they killed the rest of the women. So it was a terrible, murderous occupation for the Yazidis. And in 2016, the Islamic State were pushed out of Sinjar, which they had occupied for 2 years, by the Kurdish militia. And we went out to make this film exactly as this was happening. And we got permission to go into Sinjar, which caused me enormous palpitations. I think if I'd known that this was going to happen, I would never have gone, because I'm a natural coward. But we had this opportunity to go into Sinjar. You can see how sublimely brave I was feeling. Look at me, absolutely terrified. It's unbelievably hot. There are kind of mines everywhere. Islamic State are kind of 2 miles away over flat land. This is the period where they were kind of kidnapping Westerners and chopping their heads off on YouTube. So it's no wonder that I look miserable. And I was miserable as well, because all around were signs of complete desecration. So here is the church, founded by refugees from the Armenian genocide. They come to Sinjar, and then their descendants had run into the Islamic State. So here you can see this is the altar. The Islamic State took jackhammers and smashed it up into little pieces. Here is the font you can see in the background. That's a bomb that had been thrown in, and they've desecrated everything, smashed every decoration that they had. But in many ways, this is the most unsettling sight. So that Arabic is the word for Yazidi. And you can see that all around Sinjar, wherever the Yazidis had their home, their neighbours had written up lettering so that the Islamic State would know where the Yazidis were. And you can see what they did to that house. I mean, they've just completely torched it. So it was a very, very unsettling place to be. But as I walked the streets, I began to realise that there was one thing more than any other that was kind of opening up, if you like, an existential abyss, because I knew what had happened in that town. It wasn't just that men had been killed and women had been enslaved, which is what the Romans had done. I mean, this is, if you held out against the legions, this is the fate that would be visited on you. But there might be another fate visited on you if you were in a town captured by the Romans. And this was a fate that had been visited on Yazidis in Sinjar. There were men who had been crucified. There were men who had been suspended from pieces of wood and erected and put up. And I think for anyone in the West, the image of the cross is an image of hope. It doesn't matter whether you are a Christian or not. If you're injured and you see a van come up with a red cross on it, it's good news. But in this town, the cross represented to the people who had occupied it what it had represented to the Romans, an emblem not of the triumph of the weak over the strong, but the opposite, an emblem of the duty of the strong to torture to death those they had defeated, those who were weak, those who could no longer fight them, and put them to death. And it opened up for me the prospect of a world in which the cross did not serve as it serves for us in a church like this. It took me back more vividly than any book I had ever read, than any site I had ever visited, back into the pre-Christian world of the Roman Empire. Because crucifixion for the Romans, as for the Islamic State, was an emblem of their supremacy, of the conquests that had been given to them by the gods. And crucifixion was seen by the Romans as of all fates the worst. So if you were a provincial governor of a territory that had submitted to the Romans and there were rebels against your rule, you were licensed to kill them by throwing them to wild beasts, to be torn to pieces before the cheers of a crowd, or to be burnt to death, or to be crucified. And of these three fates, to be crucified was the worst. And the reason it was seen by the Romans as the worst was not just that to be crucified was agonizing. You would be lashed with whips that had little bits of metal in, so that your flesh and perhaps even your muscles would be shredded. You would be nailed or suspended from a tree or a plank of wood or whatever. And you would have to haul yourself up and down to stop yourself from asphyxiating. So physically agonizing. Protracted, people might be suspended on a cross for anything up to 4 days. So that was bad enough. But for the Romans, the reason why it was seen as paradigmatically the fate that should be visited on slaves. So rebels against Roman rule were seen as slaves. They were people who had submitted, and now they were rebellious, therefore the ultimate sanction could be applied on them. But it was also the fate that was visited on, you know, literal slaves, slaves who were owned, people who were human chattels. The reason why it was seen as paradigmatically the fate that should be visited on slaves was because, above all, it was humiliating. And humiliation for the Romans was kind of the worst of fates. You were put up there naked, you know, there were no loincloths. You would be an object of mockery, of entertainment for passing crowds. People would gather to watch insects buzzing around your flesh wounds, to see birds peck at your genitals or your eyes. It was the most agonizing, excruciating, humiliating death imaginable. Shocking. And so shocking that the Romans, even as they practiced crucifixion on a massive scale, found it so disgusting that they never gave an account of it. And of course, we do have four accounts, the accounts that you have in the Gospels. But it is absolutely crucial to understand how radical, subversive, and unsettling Christianity would have been to everyone in the Roman world to appreciate just how revolting death by crucifixion was. And this is what I felt more viscerally than I'd ever done before when I stood in this town where people had been crucified. And you can see, perhaps, if you bear that in mind, what crucifixion meant to the Romans, why St. Paul, when he writes to the infant church in Rome, he says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel." Now, you only say that, you know, if you're a part of you is a little bit ashamed. And reading Paul's letters again and again, you appreciate how the strangeness of it, the weirdness of it, the fact that Paul himself is wrestling with the aberrant, bizarre fact that the creator of the universe has in some way suffered this monstrous fate. And so Paul famously says of this, that the fact that Christ was crucified, to the Jews it's a stumbling block, he says. And it's a stumbling block because for Jews, the idea that the one creator God of the universe could have become a man, of course, is a shocking blasphemy. And it's shocking because they already have a covenant. And Paul is saying, no, there is a new covenant. But Paul also says that this idea to the Gentiles, to the Greeks, to the Romans, is likely to seem ludicrous, madness, folly. And of course, he's completely right. So the thing that to his Greek, his Roman audience, when Paul crosses the Mediterranean preaching Christ crucified, the thing that his listeners are liable to find weird isn't the fact that a man might be a god. The Romans live in the shadow of a man who had become a god. The fastest growing cult of the first century AD. I mean, it's not Christianity. It's the cult of a man who was the son of a god, who had brought peace to a bleeding world, whose deeds were described as euangelion, evangel, good news, and who, when he died, was elevated to sit at the right hand of his father. And this man was Augustus Caesar, the adopted son of Julius Caesar, who had become a god and who ruled the Roman world when Jesus was born. So there was nothing odd to the Romans about someone becoming a god. But what was odd was the idea that someone who had suffered the fate of a slave might become a god. That, for them, was the complete blasphemy. So this is the only physical presence we have. There are three fragments of evidence we have of crucifixion. This is from the tomb of a man outside Jerusalem, and you can see the nail through the heel bone. And then you look at this. This is the figure of Caesar Augustus. The contrast is so profound that you can understand why Paul himself keeps being surprised by the strangeness of what he is preaching. And I think that it is evident when you read not just Paul, but Christian writers in the second century, in the third century, they continue to be shadowed by almost a sense of embarrassment. They know that of all the things that the vast mass of people in the Roman world find ridiculous about Christianity, it's the fact that they worship a crucified God that is the most ridiculous thing of all. So this is a famous piece of graffiti that was found on the Palatine Hill, the place where the Caesars had their palace, gives us the name palace, dating from around AD 200. And it says, Alexamenos worships his God. So it's a kind of mocking portrait of a Christian worshipping a god with a donkey's head. And that sense of embarrassment endures even when, in the beginning of the 4th century, an extraordinary thing, Caesar himself has a vision of a cross and becomes a Christian. And that Caesar is, of course, Constantine. And from that point on, effectively, the Roman world is set on a Christian course. Caesar comes to identify himself with the crucified Christ. But that sense of embarrassment still lingers. So you still get Christian writers in the 4th century, in the decades following Constantine's conversion, kind of saying, yeah, people think this crucifixion thing is mad. And even when at the beginning of the 5th century, for the first time, you start to get artistic portrayals of Christ on the cross, done by Christians. It's as though up until that point, so that's, you know, we're talking around 400, four centuries almost after the crucifixion of Jesus, you start to get the first portrayals. And it's as though the embarrassment has lasted that long. But I mean, look at this. So this is one of the very first images. It's a series of ivories on a casket portraying the passion. So on the left, you have Judas hanging himself. And on the right, you have Jesus. And, you know, Jesus is looking amazingly buff. He, you know, you could imagine him on a Californian beach. He's got his loincloth on. He looks like an Olympic athlete. This is a man who, you know, he is Christus Victor, they called him. Christ the victor. And a victor, you know, this is someone who wins in the Olympic Games or something. This is how Jesus is being portrayed. There is no hint of the agony and the suffering that any victim of crucifixion would have undergone. And the truth is that it's not until the year 1000, so a whole millennium after the birth of Christ, that we get the first portrayal of Christ dead on a cross. So this is, you can see this in Cologne Cathedral. And it's something very radical, something very shocking. To us, it wouldn't. I mean, you'd look at it, you know, I'm sure in this church there are portrayals of representations of Jesus dead on the cross. This is the first one. And over the course of the centuries that followed, so throughout the Middle Ages, there was a growing sense of fascination, of identification with even the sufferings of Christ in a way that there had never been before. So this, I think, is one of the most terrifying and unsettling portrayals of the crucifixion ever. And it gives you, you know, you were being taken close to someone who had suffered an agonizing death here. And yet even this perhaps doesn't completely convey how awful the fate visited on Jesus would have been. And I think that part of the reason why it takes Christians so long to arrive at a readiness to portray the suffering of God the Son in this way is because so much follows from it. Paul says he took on the form of a slave and he suffered the fate of a slave. He did not come as an emperor. He did not come as a king. He did not come arrayed in purple. He ended up naked, a lump of meat nailed to a public cross. And it took Christians a long, long time to work through the implications of this. And the process of working it through transformed society profoundly and in ways that endure right the way into the present. So in the 4th century, in the decades that followed the conversion of Constantine, a time when Christians were still not representing Jesus physically on the cross, a remarkable family rose to prominence in the middle of what is now Turkey, Cappadocia, amazing place with kind of caves and things. Perhaps some of you have been there. So there was two brothers, both of whom were bishops. One of them, Basil, he built essentially the first great hospital. It was a place that was open to those who were sick. It was a place that provided refuge for those who were escaping famine and hunger. There was his brother, Gregory. Remarkably, he said, Christ suffered the fate of a slave, therefore Christ in some way is identifying with slaves. And the implication of that in turn must be that slavery as an institution is wrong, is evil. And this was an idea so radical that even his brother, the profoundly compassionate Basil, said, this is nonsense. If we free slaves, then how will they live? They'll starve to death. And there was For Basil, slavery, like famine or sickness, is part of the inheritance of the fallen world. Everyone has to suffer it. But Gregory was making this radical point. No, slavery is as an institution is an evil. It should be abolished. It was an insight that would only ultimately bear full witness centuries on. And they had a sister, Macrina, who cared for the very weakest and most vulnerable of all in society. She would tour rubbish tips that lay outside towns, and there she would pick up abandoned babies. And archaeologists, when they look at the drains of Roman cities, can always tell when a Roman city was built before, when a drain was built before the Christian period or after, because the period before is filled with the tiny bones of abandoned babies, and after it, it isn't. Macrina is the embodiment of this. She went around picking up babies who'd been abandoned on rubbish tips, either to die or to be rescued by slavers who would use them for God knows what, and she would care for them. And there's this sense of a whole new understanding, a discovery of a kind of dignity in weakness, in suffering, in poverty, that over the course of the century, you know, the 1,000 years that followed the age of Basil and Gregory and Macrina, opened generations of Christians to new discoveries. And always it was the sense that Christians were following in the footsteps of their crucified Lord. So perhaps the most famous of all the people in the Middle Ages, the saints who gave up their earthly belongings to follow in the footsteps of Christ, St. Francis of Assisi. Here he is being given the stigmata, the marks that Christ suffered on the cross, the wounds. This sense that was felt very, very viscerally by Francis's followers and his admirers, that Francis's abandonment of his wealth, his devotion to the poor, was in some way congruent with the sufferings of Christ on the cross. That it was the sufferings of Christ on the cross that hallowed and sanctified those who cared for people at the absolute bottom of the heap, and that perhaps people at the bottom of the heap were closer to God than popes and bishops and lords. And this was a radical notion, and it was a notion that unsettled many people in the Middle Ages. And so some people who gave up their wealth to go and tend to the poor would become saints like Francis. Others would end up condemned as heretics and burnt at the stake. And we are the heirs of that great discovery. That great discovery that there can be power and purpose and dignity in those who are at the bottom of the pile. And I will give you perhaps the most influential ideological expression of that. Because in the 12th century, there were people in scholars, legal scholars, preachers in Italy, who wanted to formulate an understanding of the best way to order a Christian society. What laws should underpin it? I mean, it was all very well going away, giving all your belongings to the poor and all that. But could a society function just on that basis? Maybe there was a need for a kind of a more stable legal underpinning. And so they tried to work out what a kind of Christian framework of law would look like. And so they studied the kind of the rulings of various church councils and the decrees of the Pope and so on. But above all, of course, they went back to the New Testament and the sayings, particularly of Christ himself. And there they would read that Christ had said, you know, to the rich man, give away everything and follow me. He said that, you know, give to those who are hungering, give to those who are thirsting, give to those who have no home, give to those who are weary what you can, because you may be giving it to me. And the implication of this, these scholars worked out, was that if it was incumbent on the rich to care for the poor, and Christ himself had said this, then surely the poor had rights to food, to drink, to shelter, to clothing. And this notion that even the humblest might have rights, that they had rights by virtue of being human, that there was such a thing as human rights, this, of course, is a doctrine that is absolutely still with us. And you don't need to be a Christian to believe it. It's a conviction that lots of people who might proudly say, well, I despise Christianity, still hold to, kind of almost unthinkingly. But it's human rights. You know, if you are a complete skeptic of everything to do with Christianity or the supernatural dimension, I mean, they don't exist. They no more exist than angels exist. Yet we take them in our societies, by and large, for granted. And the fact that we do ultimately goes back to that foundational image of Christianity, the figure of Christ on the cross. So how is it that we perhaps have lost our sense of that? That the association between Christ's sufferings on the cross and the fabric of charitable giving, of human rights, and so on, that link has faded? Well, I think there are various reasons. I'll just touch on two. The first is, I think, that there is something distinctive about the evolution of Christianity that has been epical, profound in it, the way that it has changed how people, not just in the Christian world but beyond, see the world, but is tied up with something that is distinctively Christian. And that is an idea, it's kind of framed in the famous story of people coming to Jesus and asking whether it is acceptable to pay tribute to Caesar. And Jesus saying, you know, asking for a coin and saying, whose head is on that? Caesar's. Well, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And that is an insight. The fact that there are rival kingdoms, the kingdom of the world and the kingdom of God, lies at the heart of everything that Jesus in the Gospels is preaching. And over the course, particularly of the history of the Latin Church, so we're all the heirs of the Latin Church, this idea that there are twin dimensions. So the church fathers writing in Latin say that there is the dimension of the cyclum, and cyclum in Latin is the churn of change, the way that people are born, live and die, that everything is flux. Everything is bound upon the cyclum. Individuals, cities, empires, all rise, all fall, all decay. There is no permanence, there is no stability. And if you want eternity, then the only dimension that you will find eternity is in the radiant sphere of heaven. And what is it that joins humanity to heaven? It's the church. And the church is the guarantee that there is a religio, the Latin word for bond, that there is a bond that joins fallen humanity to heaven. So these twin dimensions, the cyclum and religio, over the course of the centuries, this notion that there are twin dimensions starts to evolve into what in English we would call the notion of the secular and the religious. The idea that these are distinct spheres, which I think most people now, you know, across the world would take for granted. It's unique to Christianity. It comes from Christianity. It's rooted in Christian theology. So to be a secularist, to say, I have no time for religion, I am a secularist, you are marking yourself out as shaped by Christian history. Without Christianity, there is no notion of the secular. The very notion of religion is a fundamentally Christian one, as something that is distinct from everything else in society. To most people, over the course of history, it's a nonsense. The dimension of the supernatural, the dimension of the unsupernatural, they're all completely interfused. But it's Christendom that separates these two out into two opposed spheres. And it's why I think, as, for instance, concepts like human rights migrate from the dimension of religion into the dimension of the secular, so it becomes very easy for people to forget where they originated from. But I think also there is another aspect about the cross, why we have come to forget what it represented. And that is, ironically, you know, and Christianity, the history of Christianity is shot through with paradox. This is a very profound one. The cross, this emblem of, you know, a slave suffering death at the hands of the powerful, has itself become an emblem of power, of empire, of conquest. I would say the cross is the most culturally recognizable symbol that there has ever been in the history of humanity. But the reason for that, of course, is that it has been taken abroad by people with swords and guns and diseases and whips. And the cross, for many people, has become a symbol of defeat and oppression. And, of course, there is a terrible and grim paradox about that. So I think, over the going into the modern period, Christians have become desensitized to it. And there is a sense, I think, in which the modern thinker, who certainly in my opinion, you know, I found this, who most radically does have a sense of how subversive and shocking the idea of situating a man being tortured to death on an implement of torture is, was himself an atheist. So this is a portrait bust of Friedrich Nietzsche, the great German philosopher. And Nietzsche did not believe in God, but he felt that the death of God was something that was destined to bring great convulsions and upheavals, because he recognized how profound the revolution had been that enshrined the cross at the heart of Western civilization. So he wrote about it. He wrote about the Christians to devise something which could even approach the seductive, intoxicating, anesthetizing, and corrupting power of that symbol of the Holy Cross, that horrific paradox of the crucified God, that mystery of an inconceivably ultimate, most extreme cruelty and self-crucifixion undertaken for the salvation of mankind. It is shocking. He understood that. He hated it. He hated the way that it had elevated the weak. Nietzsche admired and respected the strong. But he did recognize just how transformational this Christian idea that there was strength in weakness had been, and how profoundly it shot through every manifestation of Western civilization, and how the fact that you basically, his argument is, you can't kill the Christian God and keep Christian ideals alive. And so he predicted that a terrible crash was going to come, that a time would come when Christian assumptions would be trampled down and the world would be made to run with blood. And of course, so it happened. The most revolutionary movement in the entire history of the West is fascism. Fascism was, in the way that Nietzsche had predicted would happen was a conscious repudiation of Christianity. It looked back to the period before the coming of Christ. So the fasces that give the name to fascism were the rods that were carried on the shoulders of the guards who looked after Roman magistrates. I mean, that's why you'll see them in Washington. They're emblems of the Roman Republic, which provided the model for the American Republic. But for Mussolini and then for Hitler, they served as emblems of the kind of strength and power that would cheerfully whip an uppity slave. And fascism looked to a future where Christianity would vanish. It celebrated speed. It celebrated power. It celebrated cruelty. And this, of course, was begun by Mussolini, but it was refined to a hideous pitch by the Nazis, who consciously set out to construct a new understanding of humanity and of the humanity's place in the world that would replace Christianity. And so this is a kind of, you know, it's a classic representation of it. Because the Nazis understood that their mission depended on the elimination of Christianity. And so as the Second World War began, so Himmler, in charge of the SS, who were the kind of the Nazi intellectuals, he worked out a 50-year plan of eradication. And his aim was not just to attack institutional Christianity, as the French revolutionaries had done, as the Russian revolutionaries had done, but to attack its fundamental ideological doctrines. So there were two in particular. The first of these was the notion that ultimately goes back to Genesis, the idea that all human beings are created equally in the image of God, and is given a particularly Christian expression by Paul when he said that there is no Jew or Greek. The Nazis absolutely thought that Jews and Greeks were distinct. Hitler identified with the Greeks and with the Romans as embodiments of the Nordic race, and he blamed the Jews in the figure of St. Paul for corrupting them and destroying them and bringing the empires of these kind of masterly Nordic figures down into ruin. So if the Thousand-Year Reich was indeed to last years, then he had to ensure that a new St. Paul would not arise, and therefore the Jews had to be destroyed. And I said the history of Christianity is shadowed by paradox. This perhaps is the most grotesque paradox of all, that the Jews were targeted for genocide because Hitler blamed them for Christianity. So that's one of the core doctrines of Christianity that the Nazis despised. And the other is the idea that there is dignity to be had in weakness. The Nazis did not identify with the figure of the man tortured to death on the cross. They identified with the figure of the soldiers who had lashed him with their metal-tipped whips and hammered nails through his bones and stabbed a spear into his side. Harping on and on that God died on the cross out of pity for the weak. This is from an SS magazine. The sick and the sinners, they, the Christians, then demand that the genetically diseased be kept alive in the name of a doctrine of pity that goes against nature and of a misconceived notion of humanity. The Nazis did not think of themselves as evil. They thought they were doing the right thing. They thought that humanity was divided into races, and it was their duty as representatives of the Nordic race to either enslave or destroy races who threatened them. And they believed that the Nordic race could never attain its full potential if the weak were allowed to endure. Therefore, it was the right thing to eliminate them. But both these doctrines, of course, were so profoundly antithetical to 1,000 years and more of Christian teaching that when the Third Reich came crashing down in ruin, they came to serve for the generations that have grown up in the wake of the Nazi period as emblems of evil. The Christian mythology has, for many people, I think, seems less vital than the mythology that we derive from the Second World War. We don't need hell when we have Auschwitz. We don't need the devil when we have Hitler. And I think it's not a coincidence that certainly in Europe, which of course lay directly under the jackboot of the Nazis, it was in the wake of the Second World War, and particularly when a proper understanding of the Holocaust emerged, that institutional Christianity began to decline, that people started abandoning the churches. I think because you don't need Christianity if you have the Nazis as your moral exemplar. You know, we live in a world where lots of people, when they want to work out how they should live, rather than say, let's do what Jesus did, they say, let's not do what Hitler did. That's the great commandment. It's the Nazis, ironically, who provide us with our moral lodestar. Now, of course, they provide us with that moral lodestar because they attack Christianity at its heart and because our morals essentially remain Christian. But this, you know, they are so vivid in our imaginings that we can rely on them to teach us our moral lessons. And we don't need churches in the same way. I mean, that seems to me one of the things that has happened over the decades that followed the Second World War. And so you may wonder, well, in that case, what is the future? John talked of Ron Sponberg as a man who was concerned about what the future might hold. And I agree. I think, you know, it is an unsettling, destabilizing and disorienting time. And I think that there are various possibilities of what might happen in the United States, in my own country, in all the countries in the West, and maybe one or any of these things may happen. So first of all, I think that that we are living through a period of transformation and change that can be compared to the Reformation in the 16th century. And I think in particular that the 1960s is a period of convulsion comparable to the 1520s, the period that saw Luther's teaching spread out. And essentially what has happened is that the inheritance of scripture, of liturgy, of theology has faded and it's been replaced with a vibe. People will say, I don't need religion because I already know what's right. When the Beatles sing All You Need Is Love, they're echoing Augustine and Paul. But they're not aware of that. They sing it because it seems self-evident. And that is a message that, you know, propagated by music, propagated on radios, swept the world. And this sense that essentially everything that for 2,000 years was embodied in biblical teaching or in the preaching in churches, no longer necessary. People just, you know, it's the vibe. It's the spirit of the age. We can be sure of it. But I think, I mean, it opens all kinds of questions. Can we be sure of it? Because as familiarity with the Bible stories fade, the instincts, the urges, the impulses, the assumptions that derive from the Christian heritage of the West remain vivid and alive. But there's been a sense, and I think particularly since I finished writing Dominion, in the convulsive events that emerged here in your country, and because your country is so globally influential, then spread across the world, there's a sense, I think, of people looking around for new stories, for new ways of illustrating impulses and ideas and concepts that derive from Christianity but have been severed from the bedrock of Christian scripture and doctrine. So this is a famous icon. It shows George Floyd as Christ with the Virgin. And George Floyd, I think, is filling a Christ-shaped gap. He is someone who, like Christ, suffered, was innocent, suffered at the hands of the security apparatus of the greatest power on the face of the earth. And, you know, when you're on the cross, you die of asphyxiation, ultimately. Christ couldn't breathe. But that message, that slogan, that is divorced from the cross. The image of George Floyd as Christ, that is paying homage to the Christian tradition. But with the vibe, it's kind of cut loose from that. And we don't know where it's going. And I think this is why it's so destabilizing for people. For some find it exciting, some find it threatening. But we're living in a period where Christian assumptions and ways of understanding and stories are taking on new forms. And they are transmitted by social media. They go around the world faster and faster and faster. And we don't know where they're going to go. So I think that that is one face of the future that we all perhaps are looking for, are all going to experience, this sense of a new reformation. And we don't know what we should call it. I mean, it took, you know, people in who lived through the Reformation a century and a half before they realized that they'd lived through something called the Reformation. We don't know what we're living through, but let's call it the new Reformation. So that might be one destiny. I think another endpoint might be that people will jettison Christian teaching altogether, as happened in the Nazi period, that there will be a valorization of strength. It is kind of human nature, perhaps, to celebrate the power of the strong over the weak. It's tribute to the enduring hold of Christianity, the power of its central image, figure of Christ on the cross, that people are so reluctant to do that. But as memories of the Nazi period fades, so, and I think, again, I think you can see this online in culture generally, there will be an increasing emphasis on the right of the strong to do as they wish. And that also may be part of our future. But also, I think, part of our future may be that people will want to know why the things that they feel matter, where they come from, and how they can be passed on from generation to generation. And speaking personally, so going back to my own experience, this is what I found. This is how I came to write Dominion. This is how I came to be invited to this church and to talk to you this evening, is that when I look for an explanation of where the things that I believe come from, I find it in the inheritance of Christianity, and perhaps above all, I find it in the emblem of Christ who dies on the cross and rises again. And I suspect that the realization of this will foster a revival of Christian faith, and if not of Christian faith, then at least an interest in Christianity. And I think that all of those three prospects are likely. And so I hope that, I mean, I don't want to leave on a downer, that would be terrible. I hope you feel that there is some hope in that vision. I mean, Christianity is much more vital in your country than it is in mine. In mine, it really feels that institutional Christianity is embattled and in decline. But I think even in mine, I can imagine something like that happening. And in yours, I'm sure. So, exciting times, but That is, everything about Christianity's history is exciting. Because at the heart of it, there is this sense of instability, this potential for change. It is the most radical doctrine that human imagining has ever come up with. And to build a civilization on Christian teaching is like building a city on the San Andreas Fault. Every so often, you are going to get an earthquake. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tom, for that very riveting and thought-provoking lecture and talk. And now it's time for some Q&A. I have a couple of questions already lined up to ask Tom. But while we're doing that, if you have one of those cards that you received, we ask that you would write those questions. And then Wesley, many of you know who Wesley is. Wesley, but can you raise your hand for us? Wesley's standing right there. He looks like me with a collar and a beard. And if you have your question written down, Wesley will kind of filter through them. And the reason why we're doing it this way is because in a crowd this big, sometimes we have many people asking some of the same questions. And this will help us to just kind of collapse everything into one so we can actually tackle different kinds of questions instead of more of the same kind of question. But while Wesley is doing that, Tom, I have a couple of questions for us to get us started with. The first one is this. I appreciate one of the things that you mentioned about how one of the symptoms of a civilization where Christianity becomes more and more in the background and we lose touch with Christian morals and principles is that we'll start seeing a rise again of the valorization of the strong over the weak. And I was wondering, do you already see examples of that perhaps in the West, England, Canada, United States?
Yeah. So there's the figure of Andrew Tate, who completely celebrates strength and sees Christianity as a religion for losers. And I imagine that figures like him will become more and more prominent, because in a society that lacks the supernatural underpinnings that Christianity provides when it says, the kind of the teachings of the Beatitudes that the truly blessed are those who are at the bottom of the pile, that the last shall be first. If you don't have that, then people can turn around and say, well, you know, why should I care for the weak? Why should I care for the poor? And what are you going to say? Because people, the answer that most people certainly give on social media is, well, if you don't do that, you're a Nazi. But if someone turns around and says, I don't care, so, right. Then what do you say? Yeah. And I think you're starting to see the kind of the sense of people waking up to the implications of that.
And one of the other things as well that came to mind, even as you're speaking right now, Tom, was the vast, rapid expansion in many places in the West. Canada comes to mind, some of the Nordic countries as well, of physician-assisted death or physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. And it's being expanded in some ways where it really is the government or the state taking control over the weak and saying, well, we don't have the resources to keep you alive.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that all the... I can think of no issue in the culture wars that is not in some sense an argument over Christian doctrine. And this would be a classic example. So, on the one hand, clearly, the idea that that the state should arrogate to itself the right to put people to death and allow death is shocking. Life is sacred. This is, you know, a fundamental Christian teaching. It underpins the opposition to abortion as well. And, it's embodied by the figure of Macrina, this extraordinary woman who toured the rubbish tips for a Roman, a baby like an unborn fetus or like someone with a life-threatening disease that's causing them agony. These are all people who, fine, get rid of them. whatever. And the dignity that Christianity gives them and the insistence on the primacy of life is clearly a fundamental part of Christian teaching. But so also is care for those who suffer and are sick. And if people are in agony, then there is an argument that again derives from Christian teaching, that that's what you should do. And essentially the argument over assisted dying is an argument over Christian theology and what emphasis you should give to aspects of Christian theology that in this case are starting to rub up against each other. And there are so many other examples from the culture wars of similar things happening, whether it's gay marriage or trans rights or abortion or whatever. In all of them, you can see a tension between fundamental Christian doctrines that are being brought into play against one another, and both sides are kind of passionately committed. Generally, you tend to have one side that is overtly identifying as Christian, so abortion or whatever. But the other side, even though they may be openly contemptuous of Christianity, are generally embodying Christian teachings as well. So trans rights, which is a particular lightning rod at the moment, the idea that man and woman is created separate, I mean, this is fundamental to Christian teaching. It goes right the way back to Genesis. I mean, you can't argue with it. But equally, there is it's a crucial part of the case that is made by trans activists that trans people are at the bottom of the pile, that they are the last and they should become first. And that's an argument that would make no sense outside a Christian context.
Yes, and so it is that paradox that you keep coming back to.
Yeah.
You know, and trans activists, they're not saying this is a Christian thought. But
no,
apart from a Christian world, this is not possible.
Because I think what has happened, and it's particularly evident in America,
yeah.
But America, you know, I mean, is so influential. Those of us who speak English who aren't American, we're all your your subjects. We're all part of the American cultural empire.
Yeah.
So your culture wars impact on us as well.
Right.
So what I think happened is that the last great Christian social movement in Western history was the civil rights movement that happened here in the 50s and 60s. And the arguments that were made by the leaders of the civil rights movement, you know, the Reverend Martin Luther King, they could not have been more Christian. He is couching his appeal to white Americans in overtly Christian terms. You know, he's casting Jesus as an extremist for love. He is framing the campaign for racial justice, for social justice, in terms of the Israelites escaping bondage in Egypt and being brought to the promised land. And essentially, because his arguments in Christian terms were irrefutable, and that the case made by civil rights activists were irrefutable in Christian terms, it succeeded. And it's the last example, I think, of a mass Christian movement changing the laws and the social assumptions of an entire country. But what then happened was that other activists followed in the wake of Martin Luther King and so on. So feminists, gay rights campaigners, in the long run, trans campaigners, and they are less digestible for Orthodox mainstream Christianity. And the consequence of that, in turn, is that, you know, over the 70s into the 80s, feminists, gay rights campaigners came to see the churches as their enemy. And church, and as always happens in a war, positions become more entrenched. People become more aware of the people they're arguing with as an enemy. And you have the churches, and then you have whatever you want to call them, progressives, the woke, whatever, liberals, on the other side. And that has become, you know, a complete feature of the American cultural landscape. And it's reverberating across the world. But I do think, you know, as I said, I think that progressives in the United States liberals, the woke, their assumptions are deeply, deeply Christian. Mm-hmm. They're deeply founded in, you know, they derive from Christian teaching. The very idea of being woke, of being awakened, I mean, people say the Great Awakening. You know, this spirit of a nation wanting to reform itself and come closer to the light, this has been a feature of American public life, I mean, you know, since the Pilgrim Fathers. And so when I look as an outsider at America at the moment in this election year, I see an argument over Christian doctrine in almost every point of the culture wars.
That's fascinating. It's always fascinating to have someone outside who has a better perspective.
We're suffering from it too, I can tell you.
Okay, here's another one. So the demise of Christianity in post-World War II in Europe, could it have been because the church did not stand up to fascism? And I have a bit of an added question to that as well is, fascism takes on different forms throughout history, and so how do you?
I'm not sure it does.
Okay,
I'm not sure it does. I think fascism is. I mean, just like people in the Middle Ages saw devils everywhere. I mean, if you were a heretic, you were an agent of the devil. So now people are very keen to see fascists everywhere, and I think it's a similar impulse because we equate fascism with evil,
right?
And so we are afraid of evil as something that is out there that is threatening us. But actually, I think fascism is a very distinct historical phenomenon that emerges from a very distinct cultural context. Now, it is true that fascism does mutate, particularly in Spain and Portugal, where it does take on a very kind of Catholic quality. Salazar or Franco were both Catholic fascists. But I think actually, during the, you know, in the Second World War in Germany, I think the churches are in an impossible position. I think that many of them do go over to the dark. So in Dominion, I look at this period through the prism of Tolkien, who's writing Lord of the Rings through the Second World War. And it seemed to me that what happens particularly to many Lutherans in Germany is that they are the equivalent of the Nazgul. They take the ring of power and they become agents and tools of darkness. I actually think the Catholic Church has a better war than most people are prepared to give it credit for, because although the Pope notoriously does not protest about what's happening in the Holocaust, I think he feels that the very future of Christianity is at stake. He has seen what's happened in Russia. He's seen how a great and ancient Christian civilization has been completely eradicated, it seems. And he is terrified that the same thing will happen in his European heartlands. And so he is trying to keep the Catholic Church alive while also trying to do what he can in the face of unspeakable evil. And I mean, we cannot begin to imagine the pressures that church leaders faced under a regime that was not just pledged to destroy them, but was, if you're a Christian, the embodiment of evil.
Right.
How do you live with Sauron?
Just as a heads up as well, we won't get to get through. I mean, there's tons of questions here, right? Tom Hahn has to go to bed, and so do I. So we won't go through all of them.
How long have we got?
So we'll do a couple more. What Christian virtues did the church hold dear, which were key to the success of the Christian Revolution, but which today are embarrassing or even despised by the church?
That's a really good question. So I think So I think the most... So let's look at the issue of gay marriage and why that's a problem for the church, uniquely a problem for the churches, and why it causes embarrassment to very devout Christians on both sides of the argument. As with the secular, so with homosexuality. This is a concept that emerges from Christian history. So people will talk about, say, religion in ancient Greece or Rome. There was no such thing. Religion is a Christian category. Likewise, people will talk about homosexuality in ancient Rome. There was no homosexuality. It was a totally different way of understanding the world. Homosexuality is a word that is coined originally in German in the 1860s. And it's a fusion of two distinct Christian categories. One, a sin, so the sin of sodomy, which is essentially any sexual activity that is not framed by marriage, and a Christian virtue, that of lifelong monogamous love, which is very, very distinctively Christian. The idea of marriage as something that is lifelong is something unique to, and monogamous is something unique to Christianity. And what happens in the 19th century is that those two categories, the sin and the virtue, are fused and integrated in the category of homosexuality. And so the consequence for the churches, it's an impossible bind, because do you identify homosexuality with the sin or with the virtue? And I think that society has come to accept gay rights. I mean, a seismic revolution. I mean, the most extraordinary moral revolution of my lifetime. When I was born, 1968, homosexuality had only just been legalized in Britain. And now you are likely to be arrested if you... You know, if you say you condemn it. I mean, complete moral revolution. And I think that lots of people in the church feel ashamed and embarrassed about their opposition to gay rights and look back with shame on the position that the church took. But having said that, there are deep-rooted reasons why the Christian teaching on marriage, as first articulated by Paul, is not, I think, to be condemned as backward bigotry. It's the opposite. It's everything that makes it gives. It's a way of giving dignity to individuals in human relationships that had never existed before. And so I think this is the great problem that faces the churches, is on certain ways they've been left behind by processes that they themselves set in train. I think that that's maybe currently the biggest kind of problem that they face.
One last question for you, Tom. As you prepared to write this book, did you find that your understanding of any particular historical fact or circumstance changed, or did anything especially surprise you?
What surprised me was how moving I found the testimony of Christians from every period of history. There is the most extraordinary legacy in what Paul wrote, the church fathers, the medieval philosophers and mystics, the reformers of the 16th century, Christians right the way into the present day. This astonishing legacy of reflection that is so profound and moving. And I'd expected to be bored by them. I did not think, oh, brilliant, I'm going to read Augustine or Calvin. Fun times. But they are they are profound and beautiful. And I was constantly surprised by them. And I was surprised, although I shouldn't have been, because I was the whole argument of the book was that Christian theology, in a way, is the most important thing we have for understanding why we think the way we do. But I was surprised by how profoundly theology of every period sheds light on the dilemmas that we face today. I shouldn't have been surprised by that, but I was.
Well, Tom, I cannot stress enough how invaluable your time has been for us and your insights and taking us through this thought process. And I really appreciate all that you've given us, your generosity of time, thought, especially your words. Can we give him another warm hand to thank him? If you would like to pick up a copy of Dominion, you're more than welcome to pick up. I don't know, even know how many more we have in the back because people were buying them even before we started. But if you'd like to pick up a copy, there's a few more copies there. Barbara, she can raise her hand. You can pick up a copy over there. Tom, unfortunately, has to leave. He has a nice, wonderful day tomorrow to visit the history of the Museum of Natural History. He's really looking forward to that. It's a great place. I went through it with my kids a few times. It has one of the largest T-Rex fossils in the Western world.
Be still, my giddy heart. Could I just say, once again, thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you especially to Ron's family. Really grateful. Thanks very much.